Welcome to the Peaceful Embodiment Podcast. I'm Jean Byrne.
And I'm Chandrika Gibson.
The Peaceful Embodiment Podcast is brought to you by Wisdom Yoga Institute.
We are researchers and practitioners in the field of yoga and well-being, and we're going to be having conversations on this podcast together and with interview guests around the intersection of mindfulness, yoga, and living well.
Thank you for joining us on the Peaceful Embodiment journey.
Okay, so Jean and I are going to talk about women and some of Jean's work in her PhD. I'm going to have a lot of questions for you, Jean, about
Yeah, it's a long time ago.
Well, that's all right, because I know that you live and breathe it in many ways. Things like intersectional feminism, maternal feminism, these kinds of topics. But then we also want to talk about our personal experience as women who are heading into the phase known as perimenopause and what it's like to be aging in our female bodies as we move through our yoga practices and our lives. We're going to discuss many of these kinds of topics, somewhat from my perspective, to do with naturopathy and the kind of health sciences around hormonal well-being, but also, yeah, the personal. Let's go.
So I suppose one of the things that really always comes up for me straight away, and as I reflect on it a little bit more and listen a little bit more, is getting my mind a little bit blown about the fact that while yoga is incredibly popular amongst women, there's no real history of yoga and its application towards women. If we think about it in terms of the pre-modern Sanskrit sources, women are largely invisible or objects. There's not a strong tradition of female yoginis as teachers and female practices throughout the kind of history of yoga beyond this modern period for us to really draw on. And I suppose that's quite an awakening moment, particularly when I'm moving away from certain styles of yoga or having a teacher or even having a male teacher as part of my own practice and journey. And in terms of peaceful embodiment, for me, becoming my own teacher, my own guide has been crucial. But yeah, I think a lot of the women out there, if you ever are feeling like your practices aren't necessarily speaking to your experiences as a woman, there's a really good reason for that.
Yes, and I think we've touched on before, you know, that a lot of these schools of yoga or styles of yoga, the ones that work and that are really transformative for people, can tend to be ones where you do a very structured, similar style practice every day. That's one way of understanding the benefit of those, you know, kind of formulas of practice. But for me, as a woman, a menstruating woman, I didn't ever find that worked for me. I found this ebb and flow through the month where different postures felt different, where my energy levels fluctuated. And so doing the same thing day after day, while I agree in principle with that digging of a deep well, it actually for my body wasn't right. For my mind maybe, but the two together, it just didn't hit the right tone for me. And I also know, and we've discussed before, you know, that there can be a sort of self-indulgence if you just go with what you feel. And I'm kind of naturally quite a still and slow person. If we're thinking kind of Ayurvedic constitutions, I've got a lot of kapha elements in me. Yep. So I could easily lie around over bolsters and just do restorative practice for the rest of my days.
I know, me too. I love that.
And I'd be very, very happy in some ways with that. But then there is also some benefit to approaching more vigorously. And, you know, my body's quite sturdy, so I can push myself in an asana sense. So I'm curious about this, because why haven't there been female leadership? You know, we've got so many women, and yet it still seems that it's the blokes that rise to the top that get the high profiles.
I certainly think that it's important to remember that when we are thinking about yoga practice, and today we're mainly talking about women and gender, but to remember that this practice that we're undertaking still occurs within deeply patriarchal settings and deeply patriarchal institutions. And while I do see there is a rise in the popularity of female teachers, which is fantastic given that there's so many women practicing, And even some mothers have quite a following who are dedicated yoga practitioners as well. We really need to begin to examine the history of yoga. And I think at least, I know when I was a bit younger, and I know for a lot of women, and I've spoken to young mothers who've said, oh, I just want to feel like I'm practicing, you know, something really authentic, like a really authentic form of yoga or meditation. But the problem is, whether it's the Buddhist tradition or whether it's the yoga tradition, and let's be clear, Iyengar, Ashtanga, they're not traditions, they're just styles. I'm talking Hatha yoga, the tradition of Hatha yoga or Tantra, for example. The yoga was not for women, okay? There's a whole lot of people reclaiming yoga, and that's fantastic. And I feel like in my own personal practice and in my teaching, yes, I'm reclaiming yoga. And by that, I actually feel like I'm running a dangerous line between just cultural appropriation for my own practice needs, which concerns me. Yet I'm also aware of the deeply patriarchal history of yoga and the misogyny that exists within yoga and Buddhism. So I sometimes find myself in a little bit of an uncomfortable intellectual space when I begin to examine what indeed it is that I'm doing, because I am in a certain way taking aspects from traditions and using them in a way that works for me. And I suppose while I feel like I'm doing that respectfully, I don't feel like I'm debasing yoga in terms of, you know, for me that's vinyasa and vino, or really taking it out of its spiritual context. And of course that's personal choice. But was yoga ever for me? And what aspects do I respect? Obviously, there's a deep cultural history of yoga practices in India, and I've spent a lot of time in India, and I deeply respect that. But I also know that the treatment of women throughout the world, and in India and in Hinduism, some of the teachings, and in Buddhism, is not really very helpful for women.
Yeah. So in what ways is your personal practice, where's that line, do you think, or what's going on with this idea of cultural appropriation? Because, you know, obviously, I mean, I'm walking around with a Sanskrit name, and I'm from an Anglo-Celtic background.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, the globalization has had a big impact on this. Yoga is everywhere and can't really be
reclaimed.
Owned.
Yeah.
Yeah. So where do you see cultural appropriation happening for, you know, a modern yoga practitioner like yourself in Western Australia?
So it's a big question, and I don't really have an answer. And I also, it's also feels like, and we always have this list of no-go zones and we're borderline hitting up to one, because the fact of the matter is my personal experience may not be that politically correct. And I've actually reached out to a number of people online to discuss this with them, particularly for people for whom yoga is their cultural history and background, who are, for example, Hindu, or who grew up in India. And from my perspective, it's really important to know the origins of the practices that you are doing and or the philosophical systems that you are using. And if you're using those practices for your own well-being or spiritual journey or whatever it may be that you're using those practices for, I think it's crucial that we begin to examine the histories of those practices. And we do know that yoga was in response to kind of colonialism and post-colonial India. Yoga was actively exported and shared with the world. And I'm very grateful for that generosity in doing so. But I also understand that the way in which yoga has grown is quite complicated and very much mediated by the political and the social context. And usually, you know, the main mediators have been traditionally men. I am well aware that there are women in India in their homes sharing yoga with each other, grandmother to granddaughter to daughter. And it's not something that I really, as an outsider, was able to have a deep experience of or connection with. And I think those lineages just aren't really present. But I know that there's female teachers worldwide who have connected with lesser known female teachers in India who've had practices handed down as more familial tradition. So I'm well aware that that's there. But for me personally, it's about trying to not not take for granted these practices, and also not bringing them into disrepute in a certain type of way. Yoga is a deeply spiritual practice. So for me to make it more than that, just about exercise or just about wellness, or that really doesn't sit right for me. So yeah, that it's a great question, and I don't necessarily have the right answer to it, but it's one that we all need to reflect on and, yeah, be open to listening and hearing more. But it's also okay to know that yoga has a deep kind of patriarchal and misogynistic bent in its history. And how do we deal with that? What do you think?
I don't know either. And similarly, I feel like, you know, I can't speak for what it's like for people of Indian heritage to see, you know, the boom of yoga around the world and the way that it has been co-opted and has been commercialized and has been sold with all its parts separated. So yeah, we have taken out some of the holism and some of the spirituality and some of the beauty in some ways that yoga's been expressed. But I always feel like, you know, I'm always trying to be open to learning, and particularly about marginalized women's experiences and people who come from a totally different place from me. I want to hear what they have to say. And so I have been reading and listening, as I know you have, and this is why we're discussing these things. So I tried to change one of the things that I have been doing for 20 odd years as a yoga teacher.
What's that?
Which is namaste.
I don't say namaste anymore either.
But I've been trying, and my students don't seem to want to go with me. I've shared information with them. I've shared some of the really nice blog posts that have come from teachers of Indian heritage who are explaining why it's not really, you know, it's more of a greeting and it's not really the appropriate thing to close your class with. And so, you know, last night I did this and I was like, thank you. I did my Anjali Mudra, little namaskar, thank you. But I didn't say namaste or namaskar, and they all said it to me anyway.
I was like, so okay, that's fine. I think we're at a moment where we're all asking these questions. And when Me Too hit the yoga community, I think that a lot of women were awakened to this notion that maybe the way that they have been taught and the way that they have learnt yoga has not really been for them. You know, it wasn't designed for all of these questions start coming up. And I think it's really important that we allow the questions to come up, the intersection of how do we as women navigate our practice of yoga, knowing that there's this deep patriarchal history, yet at the same time not wanting to be respectful of the culture and the origins of yoga. I think that's a really tricky question to answer. And I think what we're having is we're having this catch-22, we're having this paradox in that all major world religions are deeply patriarchal and have elements of misogyny, whether it's Buddhism, whether it's Hinduism, whether it's Christianity, whether it's Judaism. You can practice all of those religious traditions in ways that are empowering and inclusive and open, but that we don't get to deny that that is indeed the history. And I suppose for me, it just started to get a little bit overwhelming that I was practicing in ways that men had taught other men who then started teaching women. And it really wasn't working for the changes that I'm going through. And yoga wasn't necessarily, it can be wonderful for women and it can be adapted. But I know with the Yoni Shakti movement, there's this notion of really reclaiming yoga. However, I actually think that there needs to be somewhat a reinvention, because in terms of the reclaiming, the patriarchal teachings are just so deep. If you look at Prakriti and Purusha as one of the kind of foundations of some of the philosophical traditions, that's tricky, you know. Why is Purusha the masculine and Purusha is the consciousness and Prakriti is form cloaking Purusha? And it's just this ongoing tradition that we have in the world's spiritual traditions and religious traditions that women are always allocated to immanence, you know, because we have bodies, we are fluid, we have menstrual cycles, we leak milk, you know, we have a rhythmic nature to our bodies that men just do not have in the same way. They have their own rhythms, but they're not the same. And so there's this constant search in the world's religious and spiritual traditions away from immanence. But it's not just away from immanence towards transcendence. And if we go back to Western philosophical traditions, we look at psychoanalysis, this was happening in the time of Plato. You know, when we look at Plato and the cave analogy, this womb-like area that he must escape and, you know, find these transcendent forms. There's this constant movement away from immanence without any really true understanding that of the meeting place of immanence and transcendence. And Luce Irigaray calls this the sensible transcendental. It's a spiritual experience and that really peaceful embodiment of when we are fully, deeply practicing and living our spirituality in this body.
Yes, I love that. Transcendental, what was it?
Sensible transcendental, as she spoke about as a meeting place. Because basically her work and is this notion or this argument that she makes, she reads the history of Western philosophy and psychoanalysis, and we can do this in the world's spiritual traditions as well, and religious traditions, that there's a deep forgetting of the maternal feminine. So we all owe a debt to the mother for carrying us for 9 months, for birthing us into this world, for being the air that we needed in utero. You know, we only become an individual when we come out into the world and are separated from the mother. And so we have, this is unrecognized in our society. And so I suppose for me, I started to get really uncomfortable with any sort of prescriptive ways in which my spiritual practice should unfold, because I really feel like the majority of the spiritual and religious traditions have been mediated by men, by the masculine. So they don't really work for me as a woman.
Well, that's a real conundrum for us as female practitioners then, yes, isn't it? Because, you know, as you start a practice of spiritual discipline, you are looking for the roadmap, like who has trod this path before. And if I think about my bookshelf of yogic texts and spiritual books, they are largely written by men.
And how's Shankaracharya?
Or they're written by women who followed a male guru and got their sense of authority or authenticity from being a follower of that male guru.
What does Patanjali have to say about the fact that I'm woken up every 45 minutes to breastfeed and then I try to, you know, sit down in my
he'd probably say you haven't started the real work yet.
Yeah, that's back to our last podcast. It's so true. So I think that we are in this conundrum. And if you think about it, as if we are born into this world as biologically as women, we go through these certain rhythms in our gender. Is smiling at me because we know at the moment there's a debate going on about what it means to be a woman in the Twitter sphere, which we tend to try and stay away from because it's not necessarily all that helpful. But
let's stay with biology for now then.
Yeah, so people who, you know, born into the world biologically as women, they have certain rhythms in their life. And I suppose we understand those rhythms being the onset of menstruation, and then the ending of menstruation, and then whatever happens in between. For some women, that's pregnancy and the postnatal period. And many of you may not know, but Chandrika is also a naturopath. So what is happening hormonally because if you think about it, when girls start menstruating, normally in yoga tradition, yoga styles, they say, oh, age 12, that's the age you can start a yoga practice. But I think they're really talking about Brahmin boys, because that's also tends to coincide with around about the age that girls start menstruating. So what's happening for us physiologically?
Well, so much is happening physiologically. Yeah. When you were talking about, you know, being born as a female, as a woman, you have in your ovaries all of the eggs that you'll ever release, all of the ovum are there.
That's crazy.
Isn't that crazy? So you developed them in your mother's womb. So you came from her eggs and her eggs came from her mother's eggs, and you've got actually a real matriarchal image here.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. So we're carrying the previous generations in our bodies.
Wow.
And then there's this timing, you know, this natural evolutionary timing those set points come along, and when menarche comes, and yes, around maybe aging from about 9 to 14 is about the range of normal, but 11, 12, you know, that's common time for people to start menstruating. So that first period, but before that first bleed, there has been a build-up of hormones. So your ovaries have started, they're kind of dormant through your pre-puberty years, and then your ovaries start to secrete estrogen. Your hypothalamus and your pituitary gland are working together to secrete progesterone and estrogen. Then you've got your luteinizing hormones, your follicle stimulating hormones. There's a whole kind
That sounds like a lot. Is that why my friends with teenage daughters tell me that they're going off the rails emotionally? Oh, like their bodies are changing, they're wild, they're angry.
It's moody. Not their fault. They are just awash.
We should just make them a cup of tea and some toast and let them watch Netflix for a while.
Absolutely. And let them be surly and grumpy and emotional and all of those things, because these hormones are they're drivers for our emotional maturity and for our reproductive ability. But that's not all, and it doesn't matter whether you try to get pregnant or don't try to get pregnant, try to avoid pregnancy in those reproductive years between menarche and menopause. You've got this cycle all the time, so your hormones will change, and it, you know, for some women there's less fluctuation than others, so it is about living in harmony with the natural environment, I think.
Now, I think what's really tricky is when we come to yoga. If you go to India and you are menstruating, there's a whole lot of things that you are not allowed to do in places you're not allowed to
come in some places.
So in some styles of yoga and some practices of yoga, menstruation is, well, put it in the positive, some people like to see it as a time of rest, which is beautiful, and it's celebrating that rhythm. And I think that is really important to begin to rest and celebrate this life-giving potentiality, which is what menstruation is actually about. Well, it's its purpose biologically. But in some styles of yoga, for example, you're not supposed to practice when you're menstruating. And I had a very interesting debate, you know, back when I was in my early 20s. I shall not name names, but with a prominent teacher who was telling me what I should and shouldn't do when I was menstruating. And I said, well, actually, it feels very good to me to practice very gentle yoga, you know, Supta Baddha Konasana, reclined butterfly. And he was basically telling me that I was wrong. And a guy interjected and said, well, it's her body. Shouldn't she know what's good for her? And he said, would you rather believe a yogi or a confused woman? And I know, burn, it's not very nice. And I was very young at that age. I actually stayed. In later years, those sort of conversations, I just walked out. But it really just kind of conveyed to me that men have no idea what it feels like to menstruate. And I saw someone online the other day who was actually really great. He said, I keep getting questions about what to do during menstruation. And he was fantastic. Best response I've ever heard a guy say, well, someone with a lot of kind of followers on Instagram says, I don't know, it's your body, you do whatever you want to do. Whatever feels right to you is what you should do when you're menstruating.
Which is great, but why did anyone have to ask his permission for that?
So I think that's the thing. When it comes to these practices, we're asking permission. Do you mind if I modify? Do you mind if I do this? Do you mind if I meditate in that way? Can I sleep in because I have my period today on a meditation retreat? It's just spiritual practices are not very inclusive of women. And certainly when you're young, and for those who can, who have the privilege to, or who choose to be mothers, and that's not necessarily just biological, you may foster or adopt, there's lots of different ways to become a parent. There's a whole lot of other changes that occur there that deeply relate to our practice. And somehow, I think what starts to happen is that during that time period, particularly with motherhood, that somehow motherhood seems other to practice.
It's almost like some women feel they have to pretend they don't have children. What's that Annabelle Crabb quote? I'm gonna mangle this, but she said something brilliant in her book, The Wife Drought, and it became a bit of a meme, basically saying this is about workplace, but you can make it about yoga, it works just as well, that women are expected to work as if they don't have children and parent as if they don't have a job.
Yes, exactly. And so I think for many of us, we hit motherhood and it's an overwhelming experience. And particularly if we have a deeper calling to be engaged in some sort of spiritual practice. For me, motherhood, pregnancy to begin with, because there's so much happening during pregnancy, and I had a thing called hyperemesis. I was very, very unwell and I couldn't really do much yoga asana. Fortunately, my practice began with meditation. So when I hit that point, the surrender that was required of just lying around all day was hard. However, it was palatable because I had practiced stillness practices. But then when you have a baby, it's nearly that you feel like you want to erase the experience of pregnancy in some sort of way and get your body back and feel fit again. And the reality is, for those women who go through pregnancy or birth, that you have radically changed. And also, particularly if you have an empowering birth experience, and I also work as a childbirth educator, and that doesn't mean a vaginal birth. That means a birth in which you birth happened with you, not to you. And the research shows that that's a really important element of empowered birthing, is that if you have an empowered birth experience, and for me, you know, my first was delivered in a birth center on all fours, no drugs, and it was a deeply primal experience. And it really changed my self-understanding and really gave me an understanding of this matriarchal lineage of power that you're talking about. I didn't really see it in that way at that time, but it's tapping into this something that women have been doing, if they're lucky enough to be able to become pregnant, for generations. And for me, it changed my relationship with my yoga teachers at the time, and it changed my relationship with my husband, and it also changed my relationship with basically everything.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, that's okay, you know, that's okay for becoming a mother to change everything for you.
Yeah, of course. And so that is something really remarkable, that massive transformation that we go through physically, mentally, emotionally. It feels like your heart expands to love that child. And it's a massive life experience. And it is a little bit ignored in yoga land. For me, the tradition or school of thought that I was immersed in said that we shouldn't do asana during pregnancy.
Oh.
But I was always a little bit rebellious because
of course you were.
I didn't really follow the
naughty
rules.
Naughty Chandrika.
Because those rules seemed arbitrary and ridiculous and didn't make any sense to me. Now, in more recent years, I've studied a lot more things like psychoneuroimmunology and psychoneuroendocrinology do speak to some of this influence of hormones on mind states and vice versa. Mm. And so the message that I was given was that if you're doing things like warrior poses during your pregnancy, you're going to increase your testosterone and you won't be soft and feminine, which
surely
is what you need to be as a mother.
Bullshit.
I'm pretty sure that's bullshit. I can't find any I can't find any science to really back that claim up. And that's the thing that happens when you have that more sort of guru-sisya hierarchical relationship where one is the knower and one is the naive.
It's the empty vessel ready to be filled with male knowledge.
So even though it may have been a female teacher who told me that, she was echoing the words of a male teacher who just plucked it from the ether, I'm pretty sure, because probably all of his cultural and social influences were that mothers and women should be soft and nurturing and, you know, a bountiful lap for babies and toddlers to sit in, not a firm-bodied, strong, empowered warrior goddess, which is what I wanted to be.
Well, it's what you are. You are.
Yeah.
So I think that it's normal sadly, for women and for mothers to feel not quite at home in these yoga schools or styles of yoga, or even if you attend a workshop or a retreat, because the history is one of exclusion for women in yoga. And I'm just not sure how we go about reclaiming that history. And there's a great book called Is the Goddess a Feminist? And I know there's a lot of women out there trying to stop abuse in yoga, which I really support, and creating new movements to reclaim yoga. However, what I'm really unclear on is what elements are we reclaiming, and how do we extract those elements from the problematic nature of the patriarchal tradition or worldview that they're in. And an example is the use of goddesses, for example, for inspiration, for workshop names and ideas, or just even in our own personal practice. We can ask ourselves, I think what I love about the Indian tradition and Hinduism is that there are female representations of the divine, and we see that in Buddhism as well. However, and there's not really that in the same way besides, for example, Mary in Christianity or Catholicism. Yet, those female representations of the divine throughout the history of kind of the gods and goddesses of India, they're often put together with a more powerful male god who often treats them quite badly. For example, if you look at, is it Shiva and Parvati?
I'm not sure which story you're referring
Shiva
to.
Shiva and Parvati, and their son is Ganesha.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, Shiva, in a fit of rage, thought that Parvati was bathing with someone. I can't remember the story. Even if a goddess crops up, like a village goddess crops up, she's often put together with a particular consort. I just feel that female spirituality and female sexuality is so repressed and so controlled throughout all of the history of the world's religious traditions. And even if we look at Buddhism, like people use those practices, and you know, they're what some researchers called nightstand Buddhists. They have the Dalai Lama on their table without really fully understanding that the Dalai Lama has beliefs and worldviews that as a woman I don't always feel comfortable with. And for example, in Buddhism, the order of nuns died out, and we have a monk here in Perth who created a very difficult situation for himself because he ordained nuns. And this, for me, was just a revolution, amazing, and that showed such support for the depth of women's practices. However, it's died. The order of nuns has died out in many Buddhist traditions. But even if one becomes a nun, they have to abide by this thing called the Garudharma, which means a nun of 1 day of 100 years must bow to a monk of 1 day. So would you like that, Chandrika?
Oh, you can't see my face, but I'm rolling my eyes.
Yeah. So I think for me as a woman, this deep patriarchal bent is, and if we look at the kind of lived experience of women in India, though the feminine representation of the divine when it comes to law and politics and treatment hasn't been more helpful than, say, in a Judeo-Christian society. So that feels to me like an appropriation or a bit of cherry-picking aspects of traditions. Oh, well, Tantra is amazing because, you know, there's this goddess and she's this and she's that and she's powerful. And it's like, well, yeah, okay, but also women were largely invisible in Tantra and, you know, women were taken off the streets for, they were using prostitutes and really abusing underprivileged women for tantric rituals. Women really were invisible or objectified in the history of yoga. So I suppose what we're really getting at today is if you ever wonder if there's ever feels that there's a disconnect in some way with your cycles as a woman or your capacity to talk about menstruation during your yoga class or your experiences of motherhood, there's a reason for that. It's not you.
Yes, it's more of a societal issue and a historical hangover that we're suffering from. I really like those Hindu deities and goddesses as well. And I've got Sarasvati next to where I'm working on my PhD. And what I love about her is that she seems very much like a modern woman. She's got four arms. And that's something I often say to my sons, like, a woman is not an octopus. I cannot do everything. You're going to have to use your own bodies to make certain things happen in this world. But I do like that she's sort of active and engaged. And to me, she represents doing all the doings with a kind of core essence of beingness. So I love Sarasvati. And I did spend time in India when I was pregnant with my first child. And that was a really interesting experience too. I think we said this before that, you know, we are outsiders. So I'm always, you know, want to be have a bit of a caveat when I'm speaking about India. I don't want to think of it as a sort of monolithic culture.
Yeah, yeah.
It is many cultures. It's such an incredible melting pot of cultures, and in most ways a very inclusive kind of melting pot, or so it seems from the outside. But I felt like almost an insider when we got stuck in Pushkar and we stayed with a family. So we were in a family home, and the young women were getting up at the crack of dawn and cleaning the guest house, which, of course, you know, everyone's grateful for that. Who doesn't want a clean space to be in? But the son, who was also a young adult, was not doing that because his role in the family was to be the tour guide and to talk to the tourists and to develop his English skills. And I think that's probably, you know, quite a normal situation in a patriarchal society. But as someone who was pregnant at the time, and I was very hormonal, like I have this kind of estrogen dominance anyway, so I was really sick, really nauseous. I had so much estrogen flooding my system that I was always queasy. My boobs were massive, but the rest of me was shrinking because I kept throwing up everywhere.
Yeah.
That's my sorry, India. I left pregnancy spew all over India that year.
Yeah.
But you know, I was getting angrier and angrier as the days went on.
I think similarly, it's all world's religious traditions. I know my mum came from Ireland. She was raised Irish Catholic. She came to Perth. She had no license. You know, it was very difficult. She dragged four kids, age six and under, to church, got there late, and the father just told her off, humiliated her in front of the church full of people. And she said, that's it. She walked out, and I wasn't really raised very Catholic. I don't even think my siblings made their Holy Communions because of that treatment. Similarly, in Buddhism, my first meditation retreat at the Malaysian Buddhist Meditation Center, you know, I was very young and I was 20 at the time. And I remember sitting at the tables with the nuns and I ate just rice and fruit because it turns out Buddhists aren't vegetarian, as I thought they might be, and noticed the monks sitting on a raised dais, receiving all sorts of delicacies. And that actually spurred me on to the year I came back from Asia to write my honours thesis on the position of women in Buddhism, because what I noticed is that there was a lot of women, Australian women, American women, adopting these practices and becoming nuns in deeply patriarchal traditions and practices. So I suppose, if there is at all that disquiet for any of you, I think it's very hard to feel that your practice is peacefully embodied when your embodiment in the body of a woman is not really included. And something then also that now we're both heading into, which is not talked about much, is also perimenopause and menopause.
Mm.
So what's going on for us anatomically, physiologically?
Anatomically, our ovaries are doing a last-ditch attempt just in case we might want to have one more baby, or a baby if you've never had one. So there is a big surge of those reproductive hormones, but ultimately the ovaries are kind of doing this sort of spurt and stop approach as they're winding down their work. So when true menopause occurs is after 12 months of no menstrual cycle, but what it really tells you is that the ovaries are now dormant again, like they were pre-puberty. So we have coming up in our future, Jean, a really new space, and one that I am telling myself is going to be a space of great freedom, a space of liberation from these hormones that, you know, don't necessarily always cause suffering. And well, actually, for me, they do always cause suffering month after month, those few days before my menses begins.
But that's just because suffering. You're not practicing yoga correctly, Chandrika.
Well, I must be doing something wrong, Jean.
Well, this is what I've been told by my male yoga teachers. Actually, I've had male yoga teachers also tell me that if I was an advanced practitioner, I would stop menstruating completely.
I think they mean if you're an anorexic practitioner.
Yes, with a low, much too low BMI, because that makes all the fancy jumping through and jumping around, at least in Ashtanga Vinyasa yoga, a bit easier.
Mm-hmm. I think it makes a lot of styles of yoga easier, actually, to have that very lean body type.
So but it's not nourishing. And as a woman, I think it's also important for us to know that, so we go on this journey in terms of those of us born biologically as women. There's other people who identify as being a woman who don't have the same biological background. But we need to be aware that that lead up to the end of, you know, our reproductive era can be long. You know, it's perimenopause. It can last a short time. It can last 5, 7 years.
It can be a decade.
It can be a decade. And so I suppose one of the aspects that I'm noticing, you know, and people call this the wild or wise woman phase or the crone era, is that less care and interest for my appearance. As we age, our body is going to change. The wrinkles are coming. My hair is getting grey. And, you know, I think when women can find themselves at a point where how they look is not quite as important to them as how they feel, that really paves the way for that kind of experiential understanding of being peacefully embodied. What do you think?
Absolutely. And for me, that has been part of how yoga has kind of worked on me and taken me away from that body image consciousness that, you know, all of us are swimming in all the time.
Yes.
We're saturated by media images of how a woman should look and what is considered conventionally attractive.
Mm.
And, you know, maybe this is the rebellious part of me as well, but pretty early on, I found yoga to be a real respite from that. Except in certain environments, certain yoga studios that I have visited even as an international yoga teacher trainer, I have visited yoga environments where I got the whole look up and down, like, what? You're the teacher? But you don't look like, you know, a lean bodied model on the cover of Yoga Journal. How can you be the one who is leading this, who is the knower of this? And I felt in a way that I had to prove myself. But equally,
because yoga occurs in a specific type of body.
Yes, and to sell it, it's really beneficial to have a specific type of body because that is the commercial reality of media. It's a very visual messaging that we have in yoga. So,
and there's a very normative understanding of what one looks like from practicing rather than really focusing on how practice makes us feel.
Mm, that's right. And even in more recent times here, I've entered into environments where the conversation amongst other women who are there to do yoga, maybe before a class starts or something, is really body shaming, really talking about how they've been bad because they overindulged or, you know, that their belly is getting in the way of their yoga and I must do something about it. Or I went to a compassion workshop, a really, really good training. I loved it. But over the lunch break, even though that was the topic and all the people there were, you know, very thoughtful and reflective human beings.
Yes.
Over the lunch break, as we shared a beautiful meal that someone had prepared, there were people talking about how they can't have that because they're getting weighed tomorrow or they, you know, they want to fit into a certain outfit. And I found it really shocking that we still are struggling with these same issues and that individual women are carrying around in their own minds so much content. How much space is it taking up in their brains to think about every morsel of food they consume?
And I think as women, we have actually a responsibility to other women to celebrate the body that they are in and to make sure that perhaps if we're a teacher, that when they're practicing with us, for one, a complete no-go zone for me is this notion that, oh, you know, it's been Easter and I've been to classes, you've eaten too much Easter eggs, better get yourself on the mat. That equation doesn't really, obviously, if we want to remain at a set weight, we need to think of calorie intake and exercise and all of that. But it's really not got anything to do with yoga. It really has very little at all to do with yoga. And yoga is not a weight loss tool. Yoga is a tool to help you feel good about your body and in your body rather than looking at it constantly from the outside and criticizing and analyzing and judging it.
Mm. And one of the benefits of yoga is actually that it slows your metabolic rate.
Yes.
Because in that sense, it's anti-aging. You know, it increases your telomerase, this enzyme that helps those caps on the ends of your DNA strands to not age so rapidly. It's got lots of benefits physiologically. So it's not that we're ignoring the body or saying that, you know, body consciousness isn't the right approach to yoga. We're bringing the body to yoga, but bringing the body to yoga with kindness and self-acceptance, that's what makes it radical. That's what makes it different from every other
practice
form of exercise
out there, running or bar or
yeah.
the gym.
Yeah.
And I think for many of us, it's lot of these conversations come about at perimenopause and menopause as well, because perhaps there is a chance that yoga has controlled your weight in a certain way. And I know that that's definitely been true for me in my life. And now my body is changing and I'm not willing to undertake the practices and the orientation to yoga and the asceticism, which is, there's a harshness in the history of yoga. You know, people going out to the forest and they're not eating and they're doing this and they're doing
hold
that.
Hold your arm up.
Hold your arm up or only roll off. Around. And the fact of the matter is, as we age, our bodies will change. Our bodies are going to get, as women, a little bit softer. You know, a little bit more round. Our hormones will be different. Our state of mind will be different. And I suppose for me, the question is, well, how can my practice be one that embraces that? And I've actually, on certain days, started practicing in a way that's a lot more fluid. So there's not really end points or end postures. I still love a few, you know, handstands and all of these sorts of things. However, quite often I'm seeking out a certain softness in my practice rather than having this really ascetic, pushy approach, because I think when you feel good in your body, when you feel like you're feeling it from the inside out, there's a lot of gratitude and a lot of respect. So as we move into perimenopause and menopause, our body begins to change. But one other thing I think I'd like to mention is rage.
Oh, yes.
So we have fluctuating emotions as women. That's okay. Men have fluctuating emotions as well. Something's occurring, though, which I'm trying to embrace and be okay with, that as I go through this stage of life, sometimes I feel a real intensity of anger. What's going on there? I mean, I know you feel it too. But what's going on there physiologically, and what's going on there, I don't know, in general? What's that about?
Yeah, look, there's lots of possibilities. And for individual women, it's going to be a different picture.
Course.
But in general, when your progesterone drops, you do become a little bit less sweet-natured.
And a little bit less tolerant.
A little bit less tolerant, yeah.
Well,
a little bit more edgy.
Maybe that's okay.
So one of the benefits of yoga, if you want to feel not angry, is that by using it as a stress-relieving practice, so it does lower, you know, your cortisol and your stress hormones, your chemistry changes.
Because a lot of women experience anxiety and depression during perimenopause and menopause as well, don't they?
Yes. So yoga as a form of medicine for that phase of life is a beautiful thing, because your nervous system, and in particular that kind of sympathetic nervous system reaction, the fight flight kind of drivers, they are really mediated through the relaxation response. So you can bring down those hormones, and by doing that you don't use up so much of your progesterone. So what we kind of want, if we want to feel happy and not so cross, is our estrogen and progesterone to work in tandem and to be quite well balanced. So when I said that I'm always a little bit off in those few days before I bleed, that's because to prepare for the loss of the endometrial lining, the progesterone level drops and you're left with unopposed estrogen. So if you have that kind of pattern, then you get like the tender breasts and maybe the carbohydrate cravings.
Definitely.
And then you'll either go, depending what's going on in your life and the ways in which
you've
been conditioned.
So why on earth would you just not do yoga then, like your male yoga teacher tells you to, or
oh,
not
no,
go to
practice,
the temple, or
but you can adapt your practice to be kind of self-supportive during that time. So you'll either go to tearfulness, and you know, puppies will make you cry, or you'll go to rage, or you'll have a bit of a fluctuation between the two. And what I feel is true, and I don't know if there's evidence for this, but I feel like whatever you're getting angry or sad about or having strong emotions about when you're premenstrual, that's real. That's a real issue, but you're just masking it, and your hormones, your progesterone in particular, is making you feel like you can tolerate it through the rest of your cycle.
Well, I think as well, this really comes to bear in the perimenopausal and menopausal times, in that sometimes I have rage moments, you know, and I don't want to walk around the world being angry or raging at everyone. But the other night, not harshly, but I expressed it because there was a little bit of chocolate left in the fridge and I was planning on eating it, but other people had eaten it, even though I'd done all the food shopping and I'd cooked everyone dinner and I had played my role to perfection. You know, there was someone in the house, there's only three other men in my house, who had just failed to say, would you like some chocolate? Or do you mind if I eat the rest of it? And for many hormonal women who do enjoy a bit of chocolate, that's not a good moment. But they said, I didn't realize you liked chocolate that much. And I said, I don't like chocolate that much, but I like to be asked. And it feels like I am honored and respected when the work that I am done is being seen. And so I think that as we get older, we get less okay with playing the game. You know, I am a loving and generous and kind mother, but my female friendships have become more and more important. And just knowing that the women like you in my world and other women that I'm connected to also understand that actually it's time for a little bit of pushback, particularly in our family lives. And we all have wonderfully supportive partners and children, so that's great. But to that we can listen to those fluctuations of emotion. Yoga and meditation would make people think we need to repress those, but often expressing that anger is important. We don't get angry at people, but we can express that we feel angry in order to create the conditions for change.
Yes, and that can then fire you up to work for justice across lots of different dimensions of your life. And so I do really feel that there's a freedom and a power coming as we come towards the end of our reproductive years and we're no longer so bound by even family life. I mean, we both enjoy family life and love nurturing our families, but we don't
but we
have
are our
to
own
as they become
separate.
Yes, we're
that.
Our own person. We've got our own interests and pursuits. And as our children grow, they also become more independent. And so hopefully the timing works, and again, different in different people's lives. But as we become free of our menstrual cycle, we also become free to really immerse ourselves in our passions and our interests in a really different way. Like we're preteen in our bodies and mature in our minds. How fantastic.
I think it's just it's a wonderful journey that we are fortunate enough to go on. And while sometimes it feels difficult, these rhythms that our body goes through, I think that in this moment there's a really fantastic opportunity for us to reinvent our practices according to our own rhythms and understanding that woman is not a homogenous term. There's practice will look very different for all sorts of women at all stages of life.
Yes, and that circles back really nicely to that idea that you just said about reinventing. I think we're not returning to anything.
I don't want
that's
to return. I don't want to reclaim a patriarchal history that doesn't speak to my experience.
And we can't kind of hold how yoga was in the deep dark past that we don't know really on any kind of pedestal. That seems really misguided because we have so much different information.
Well, what the Buddhist monks, male monks, have to tell us about our practice. There can be some helpful information there, but also at a certain point, we do need to become our own teacher.
Yes.
Or have a circle of women to support us in our practice.
And peer support, I think, rather than hierarchical leadership.
Go
us.
Yeah. So thanks for listening, and we will see you or chat to you all again soon.
See ya.
Bye.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Peaceful Embodiment podcast today. If anything that has been discussed in this episode has raised concerns for you or equally has inspired you and sparked ideas that you would like to get in touch with us about, you can reach out to us through our various social media platforms.
We would love you to subscribe to this channel, leave a review, and feel free to share this podcast episode with your friends and family. Be sure to find us on Facebook and Instagram at Wisdom Yoga Institute.